As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to the Total Soccer Show and our latest batch of listener questions. Today, we're talking about the Premier League Golden Boot race. We're pitting Ancelotti against Guardiola, and we're surveying the Champions League's most joyful moments. My name's Ryan Bailey. Joining me today, your joyful co-host, Taylor Rockwell. Hello, Taylor.
Hello, Ryan. How are you, my friend?
I'm very good. See, the joy already coming across in your first few words there. Wonderful to have you, Taylor.
Wonderful to be here. Now I have to keep this going and plaster on a fake smile to do so at the same time. Hello, everyone. How are you?
Yay! I hate this. Joe Larry's here. No fake smiles here. It's all genuine teeth showing.
Oh, yeah.
Teeth showing?
Taylor sounded like you were doing a book reading at an elementary school. That's what that tone gave me. Like, all
Hello.
Right, kids, oh. let's gather oh. around. Yeah.
Eyes up here. Eyes
and,
up here.
And now the thing is, you've committed to doing that for 65 minutes or so. So this will be fun.
Joe, catch a bubble for a second.
Have you done that at like daycare or anything, done some book readings or anything, Taylor? I reckon you'd be quite good at that, getting the kids sitting in a semicircle and eyes up here.
I think like the person to whom I logically compare myself in that scenario was George Bush doing the book reading to the young children. So by comparison, yeah, I think I'm doing a better job than him, especially given the circumstances of that one.
You'd be like, eyes up here, guys. I'm about to describe from Zlatan's book how he's a Ferrari, not a Fiat. Are you ready, guys? Yeah, that'll be good.
Who's the Italian striker who like lived in a hotel and claims to have like betted a different woman every night?
Cassano,
I think Cassano. It is. Let's read his biography and see how that goes.
Oh boy, that is not for the youth crowd, I would suggest.
No?
Power okay. Trio here on Listener Questions. No Graham Ruthven. He's still in Florida. Wrestling a gator, I believe, is what's on his itinerary today. Have fun with that, Graham. Patreon.com/Total Soccer Show if you would like to support our show. Thank you very much to everyone who does so already. We've got bonus podcasts on there. We've got bonus video content and access to our Discord where all the cool kids are hanging out. Coming up on the bonus podcast feed this week, we've got a bonus listener question coming up, which will be very good. It involves Gianni Infantino. That's from our friend Cigar Suramigiri, who suggested a question we'll be tackling on the bonus feed. And also, Father Quizmas. Father Quizmas is going to be here.
Yeah,
he's going to be bringing some presents.
And he's going to bring me my second title in as many weeks. I love Father Quizmas.
Ooh, Father Quizmas bringing the quiz trivia magic to the bonus feed. Patreon.com/Total Soccer Show. Please and thank you very much.
If you win one round of trivia, is it a title? Are you a champion?
No, so you just said I won. So yes.
All right. I look forward to this next quiz in which I will annihilate you. Thank you, Joe. Then I will be the champion and have the title.
Yeah. That part I agree with. Whoever wins is the champion. I think we can all unite behind that idea.
I guess they do say you're the Jeopardy champion, don't they, at the end of every
episode. Because you won. See, okay. Look at this. We're connecting dots left and right.
And if you win 10, you get a star that you can put on your t-shirt while you record the podcast.
That's true. Wow. Okay, this just got serious.
Yeah, and then Milan fans tell you one of your titles didn't count, actually, and you're down to 19, and it gets complicated. Anyway, let's go to the list of questions from today's episode. Asher Belanger, who has been in touch with this one. If MLS adopted a closed promotion relegation system with the current 30 clubs, I'm assuming we're including San Diego in that count, so a 15 and 15 system there, would that balance the schedule and make a better product for MLS? Who would be the yo-yo clubs in this hypothetical situation? Joe, we should probably start with addressing this question in saying that never gonna happen, right?
Yeah, I would be very, very surprised if this happens within our lifetimes. Probably never. It's not impossible, and the only reason I say it's not impossible is because Asher does specify a closed pro-rel system, so this would still be like MLS's version of promotion and relegation, where they would get to control the teams. There'd still be something of a floor, right? You can't just bottom out across the entire American soccer weird misshapen pyramid. This would get around some of those concerns. But I have a really hard time imagining any MLS owner saying, yeah, we'll go down a tier for no reason whatsoever. I don't envision this happening. That said, I desperately want it to happen. Like, pro-rel is so much fun. It is one of the most interesting wrinkles in all of sports, soccer or otherwise. And it does genuinely bum me out that we don't have it. I understand the reasons why. If I was an MLS owner, I think I'd be pretty sympathetic to the idea of not having pro-rel. People can come for me if they want, taylor@totalsoccershow.com if you want to email any complaints along the way. I think this would be fantastic, though, for Major League Soccer, at least as a spectator. This would be absolutely fantastic. And there are motivations as an owner, if you have financial skin in the game, to do this, right? The bet that you're making is, hey, if we institute pro-rel, even if my team gets relegated, which we're not because my team's going to be really good and really smart, that's what owners should be saying, like, even if we get relegated, the boost that comes to Major League Soccer from instituting something like this is worth that risk, right? And we can fight and we can get back up top. So it's not just an automatic no, but I think for a lot of these owners, it's an automatic no. But that aside, yes, I would absolutely love this. I actually don't think 15 clubs is quite enough, to be honest. I think you go to like 36 or to 40 teams and split it into two, and you have an 18-team league or you have a 20-team league.
Stop giving them ideas, Joe.
Well, I mean, if we're going to do the pro-rel thing, there's room for more teams. There's absolutely room for more teams. 15 in a league is too small because then you end up with a weird kind of short schedule, although maybe that lets them squeeze League's Cup 2.0 with, like, I don't know. Maybe this
Scotland
is what MLS wants
hi,
all
also.
Along.
Scotland says hi, Joe.
Just Scotland saying. Says hi. Maybe this lets MLS add even more games and they're going to do 7-game playoff series. Who knows, right? But I like the idea. The only loser here, as I kind of said, is the owners, notable losers as they are. If we stick with 30 teams, my picks, I got a couple picks for yo-yo clubs.
Wait, Joe, before you do the yo-yo, can I respond to some of the things
go.
You've said? Because first of all, I feel like it's been discussed before, the 20 and 20 closed pro-rel system as a possibility for how you could do pro-rel. And it seems like something they might be more inclined to do if numbers don't continue to increase the way they want them to, if there isn't the sort of attention and the viewing audience that they need, if they do end up having to experiment. That is a way they could do it. And I think you could get around some of the ownership concerns by just doing a pretty strong revenue share. So even if you're in the second division, you're still making profits. You are still sort of able to function. And so for the owners who don't maybe want to spend a ton of money, they can spend less money, still be competitive in a league, and still get the money while being in a closed MLS structure. I don't know if that would bridge that gap, but I do think it's something they could entertain down the road if they did want to expand to, say, 40 teams. And I would love it because I think you could then have, let's say they stopped at 36 for a while. 18 and 18, you're still getting a 34-game season, but now you're getting the equal table, so you could eliminate playoffs. I think more likely is that they would go all out, and they would have a like top of MLS 1 playoff. They would have a relegation playoff, and I think then you could have a relegation playoff against the MLS 2 teams coming up. But I think you could just keep adding in different competitions that would keep eyes on the
league. You just hack the system. You just bill it as like, guys, this lets you do more playoffs. Isn't that what you want? More playoffs. Here you go. You're like dangling it on the stick. I think this is great, Taylor.
Pretty much. And then like you could even do like the bottom half of MLS 2, the winner of that one gets like entry into, I don't know, like they go straight to the US Open Cup final since y'all don't want to play in that anyway. Why not? I don't know. But I think there's ways to make it creative. I think it would be really interesting because you could also toy around with how you do playoffs. So like the relegation playoffs, I guess the worst teams get byes because then you have fewer opportunities to get out of the relegation battle. And I think you could just toy around with stuff and continue to pull people in that way by being innovative. I also think, final thing would be, that it would probably pull certain teams out of the relative malaise that we sometimes discuss them being in. So I look at an organization like the Red Bulls, who it feels like have learned They don't have to spend a ton of money. They're not going to get relegated. They can be competitive. They can make the playoffs. They'll be fine. I don't think the Red Bulls would be okay with the possibility of being relegated. Certainly, they wouldn't be okay with being relegated to begin with. So, like, I initially thought maybe they're a yo-yo club, but they seem like one that would immediately start spending money to make sure that they are not in that position. And so in that way, I think you would then get owners like, is Robert Kraft going to be okay with the Revs being relegated? Probably not. So then does he start spending money? Does he kind of care more? I think you would get Robert Kraft is the owner of the Revs, right?
Yes,
before I go
correct.
Too far. Thank you. Making sure. He also is equally confused as to whether or not he owns them. But I think that might sort of get some teams out of that malaise. And in that way, I think that would also be pretty interesting and pretty useful.
Well, and that's the big thing, right? That's the whole benefit with ProRel is that there are consequences to your incompetence. Yeah. So there's more motivation to be competent, right? Like that's the whole thing. The question for MLS has always been and will continue to be whenever ProRel is discussed, even in a hypothetical manner, like, are they willing to take that risk? Like, what is the financial drop off from being in, even in this closed system from MLS 1 to MLS 2, it's harder to bill like a game between two teams that are in the second division of Major League Soccer. Like that's huge in a landscape where we're still trying to get a feel for how many people in the United States care enough to watch Major League Soccer as it exists today without it being divided up into a top tier, which we already have, and a second tier, which we don't have within the MLS structure. Like that's a sizable risk. And I think it's going to be a real risk that owners are unwilling to take for a long time. But I love that point, Taylor, about it driving some of these teams to aim higher, because I think it absolutely would. The question is, you know, are they going to be willing to accept the risk that comes ahead of that stuff? In terms of yo-yos, there's one that came to mind for me first, and maybe this is just a brutal turn for this group of fans, but Nashville SC, just give me yo-yo club vibes. Like something about them, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's how they build the roster. Maybe it's how Gary Smith tends to play. Like they're not trying to go out there and control games like, you know, a lot of the elite teams do in Major League Soccer. They kind of are okay to set up to play against the ball, whether that's with a high press or with a little bit of deeper defensive action. And they're going to try to absorb and they're going to try to hit quickly in transition. I just get the feeling that if like MLS was the Premier League in one way or another, Nashville would sort of be down in that 17th, 18th spots and kind of bouncing back and up, back and forth, maybe up a couple years, down the next year, back
Crystal
up the following
Palace,
year.
Stoke City, maybe years
there's,
ago.
Maybe there's some of that vibes here with Nashville. So that was my first pick.
Does Palace have a soccer Jesus as well? I think maybe they do.
I think they should. If they don't. The other one I had on my list, and I really struggled. We talked a bit pre-show. I feel like I overthought the yo-yo clubs thing, so I'm excited to hear what Taylor has. DC was another one on my list. I'm not even sure that they're strong enough to be a yo-yo club. Like, yeah. I think they might end up sticking down lower, but I also think that applies to so many of these teams in a 15-team league. Like, I'm not exactly sure who those fringe 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 clubs are, but in this new era for DC, where there's Ali Mackay running the show in the front office, Troy Lesane, it's, I think, maybe the youngest tandem between a CSO and a manager in Major League Soccer. Ali Mackay certainly is the youngest CSO. Like, maybe they're breathing enough new life into this club that if it was already split into two divisions, then before DC would have definitely been an MLS 2, and now they might be pushing for promotion. I don't know what that's going to look like, but DC and Nashville are my two nominations.
DC United sometimes have the vibe of the person trying to parallel park, and they end up like 3 feet away from the curb, and they just think like, yeah, that's good enough. I did my best. Like, I'm with you, Joe. I'm not sure they would even be in the yo-yo category, because they would be, this is the year, and then they would finish like fifth in MLS 2. So I'm not even sure I had them as being consistently in MLS 2, much as that pained me. The yo-yo ones that I lean towards, Dallas maybe, though I think if there were going to be a divide, I think their owners might be willing to change the way they spend. Maybe they're already doing that. Maybe they see ProRel coming. Probably not. But I think Dallas, for how their model has oftentimes left them sort of lower in the table at times, but then they're still able to make the playoffs and still kind of be comfortably in those conversations, if you're splitting it in half and you're still relying on youth, I could see them being a team that occasionally has a good season and comes up and stays up, and then occasionally has a down season and they sell some players and they go back down, and that seems like they might be okay. Then again, maybe the hunts would change and start spending money. Austin, at least for now, feel like one where they're sort of could hit and be good and then could sort of not spend enough, not have the depth they need, and go back down and sort of have that sort of back and forth. And then Joe, the one that I feel least comfortable with, because I feel like their fans are going to be annoyed by it, But it's just the way the last couple seasons have gone, or at least the last season, is Kansas City. That they seem like a team that are content to start very slow, don't get overly stressed if that's the situation, and, you know, like last season, end up making the playoffs. But as you often say, that's a very low bar. Yep. And they just feel like a team that can splash, can have big names, but still doesn't reach that like level of they are a marquee team that's going to be in that conversation routinely. They feel like one who maybe won't be fully yo-yo, but will be near the bottom of MLS 1 and then occasionally flirt with that relegation spot.
No, I love that. I went and ran the numbers for ASA when I realized that maybe I was overthinking some of this and looked at over the last 5 years, American Soccer Analysis, I should be clear. And I looked at the last 5 years, the point totals for every team in Major League Soccer. The expansion teams are getting shredded here because they haven't played enough games. But it still generally gives us a decent idea. SKC, 13th in the last 5 years, which is literally exactly where you just had them, Taylor. Maybe not quite auto-relegated, although I don't know what we're doing in a 15-team league in terms of auto-relegation spots.
Oh, it's definitely playoffs the whole
way. Oh, it's a triple playoff system, yes, right? Yes, yeah, don't worry. My bad. It's a 12-game series that then plays. Yeah, okay, I'm with it. They're 13th in this category. Montreal sort of feel like maybe they're in this conversation. They're 14th along the way. FC Dallas in 16th. Vancouver, 17th. Colorado, 18th. I think maybe those are some of the ups and downs clubs, although I'm not sure that maybe a club like Colorado has the staying power. But hey, this is 2024 and we're getting a new look for them. So, you know,
Vancouver's a good shout. Vancouver's one.
Yeah, they feel like they might do a bit of bouncing here along the way. Nashville sort of in this conversation. Houston, maybe one of those teams, even though they were really good last year. We talked about them in glowing terms yesterday as well on the MLS show. The reason why I struggled with this so much is it just feels like there's so many clubs that are yo-yo-y.
Yeah.
MLS is so parity-filled. That's really where we're at. Like, Ryan, I was going to ask you about Charlotte. They maybe calling them a yo-yo club, given that they've been, what, ninth in the East both their first two seasons, I guess would be a bit generous. But could they be an MLS one? Yeah, because there's like nothing separating a lot of these teams.
Well, Joe, in this system, I imagine the MLS 2 clubs would all be in the playoffs for promotion. So every one of them is a contender to go up. So every one of them is a yo-yo club potential.
I love it.
Ryan,
I don't love it.
Maybe you're not in a position to agree or disagree, but I also think if my model is we're doing a ton of revenue sharing, so you're sort of incentivizing owners to be okay with being an MLS 2. David Tepper strikes me as a person who, if you tell him, you're going to make the same amount of money coming in, you're going to have to spend less, and you'll get to be competitive while spending less. I feel like he would take that offer. So he might be okay with MLS too. Though I guess that could then mean they get up and they go back down. So maybe they end up a yo-yo club.
He'd say, wait, can I charge $19 for the beers? And they say, yep. And they go, yep, I'm in. I think why I started this question saying never going to happen, because as we've outlined, as Joe outlined, current owners probably wouldn't tolerate, certainly in the first year of this happening, automatically being relegated to a bottom tier 15 of them at least. But the more we've talked about it, and we've mentioned maybe going up to 40 teams, adding in 10 expansion teams over however long a period, for MLS, at the current market rates, they're getting Cha-ching. $5 billion for that.
Yeah.
So there is some incentive to make that happen if they were to, say, profit share from that and promise current owners a cut of that pie, perhaps. That might push it over the line.
It would be a fascinating exercise to try and game this out. I'm not sure it's one we could do fully because we don't have access to the current financial information. But I was thinking about that as well, Ryan. That's a huge amount of money where you can't really justify it. Maybe MLS can because they seem to be able to expand regardless. But it seems hard to justify to your fans adding 10 more teams in right now and still keeping the current structure. They don't care clearly about the schedule being balanced because it's not, and this would help solve that, obviously. But they don't seem to mind that too much. But I don't really think you end up in the same stratosphere as the other American sports leagues that MLS is in some ways trying to model itself after by having just so far and away more teams than any other league in the United States. So at that point, maybe you do have to change it, whether it's conferences, whether there's some upward and downward mobility. I don't know what that looks like. But that cash flow coming in from 10 extra teams is massive.
It is indeed. Very good opening question from Asher. Thank you very much. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're talking Premier League Golden Boot. We're talking about Tim Ream's career and much more back shortly.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. you can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Catch all new episodes Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Total Soccer Show's listener questions. We go now to a question from Trent McJivers, one of my favourite handles we have riding into this here show. Who's going to win the Premier League Golden Boot? And if Haaland is still the favourite, who's most likely to pass him? Taylor, we have Mr. Erling Haaland, and I believe the Chelsea FC man with the whole club on his shoulders, Cole Palmer, both on 20 goals at the moment. Ollie Watkins on 19 as we record. And then got Solanke, Isaac and Salah on 18 and 17 and 17. I've said that poorly. But it's quite a tight race with a few matches to go in the Premier League. It does feel, logically, Taylor, like it is a race between Haaland and Palmer at the moment, though.
Does it, though? Does it? I hear where you're coming from. I did enjoy the same Chelsea supporting buddy I mentioned on the weekend review messaged me yesterday.
Get
after
this guy on the pod, man. Get this guy on the pod.
Hi, Matt, if you're listening. He messaged to say, Pochettino, we are not Palmer FC. Arrested Development narrator. Yeah. They were. yesterday did not go well for them.
That's
so
a tweet.
Much. So you look at it, yeah, you've got Haaland on 20, and then you've got Cole Palmer on 20. Both of them have six games left to play. Ollie Watkins in between 19 with four games to play. And I think Watkins only having those four games hurts him quite a bit, because I think they're still going to be scoring goals, and I think he'll get at least a few along the way. But I think with two fewer games and just like less quality around him necessarily, though Villa have obviously been excellent and are ahead of Chelsea, I don't know if he will score enough to really pull ahead of Haaland to the degree that would be required. I think Haaland with six games to go, nothing this summer, so it's not like they're saving him for anything like that. And it's also not like they really can, because at this point, there's a potential that the title could come down to goal difference. So I think he's going to be playing. He's going to be scoring goals. I do have him as far and away the leading candidate. I see why you would lean Cole Palmer. I still have questions about Chelsea and their consistency and their and concerns over...
Oh, you do?
Oh, yeah, I know. I'm the only one, right? So weirdly, I actually have a guy who would have to close a lot of ground. Dom Solanke is in there as well with 18. But I had Alexander Isak as the one I would lean towards as being a possible dark horse candidate here. He's only on 17, does have the six games left. They would be Palace, Sheffield, Burnley, Brighton, Manchester United, and Brentford. Manchester United, theoretically, the most difficult opponent there, maybe Brighton, although they've been sort of vulnerable.
United
at
will
times.
Allow him to have 18 shots, though. So
yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. So I feel like he'll still get a goal or two against United, and has been scoring plenty. So I wonder if he could be a cheeky one, where if Haaland does maybe run into a patch where he only gets a couple goals, then it's like Haaland, maybe if he gets three, he's at 23. Could Isak score a goal a game or more? That's tough, but that's why I think it is Haaland as the clear favorite. I look forward to hearing you all agree or disagree.
Okay. Joseph, I contacted a betting emporium and offered to give them some money for the prospect of Cole Palmer getting the Golden Boot. And in return, they'll give me more money than I gave them originally if that prospect comes to pass. So Cole Palmer is who I'm thinking is going to do it, just because, I don't know, it just feels very erratic.
But if you bet on Haaland, they'd be like, no, you don't get your money back?
Oh, I could have done the same arrangement, but I've chosen not to at this point.
Wait, so sorry, Ryan, what's your... I don't have Cole Palmer
winning.
Ryan
bet on Cole Palmer.
I think that is a defense. I like how you sort of constructed the scene where you like sent them $2 via carrier pigeon or something like that, and they sent you a handwritten note
agreement.
Back. Yeah, it's nice. What's your Palmer reasoning there?
I just think that... If Haaland or Palmer,
English is his reasoning there.
Well, they're both English. Haaland's English as well, Taylor. We know where he was born.
Not today.
if I was going to bet on one of those having a dry well over the next few games, it would be Erling Haaland. That's my logic, Joe.
So you just think Haaland's going to cool off? That's all. Okay,
or
that's fine.
Remain relatively cool.
And I think there is something to that. I don't agree with you, but the thing that I have against Haaland's candidacy, although I like the Palmer shot, I like the Isak shot as well, is that Haaland's right now dealing with a little bit of
a knock.
I saw
your face. You didn't like the Isak shot.
No, I don't mind it at all. A lot of this for me depends on Haaland's muscle injury that he's dealing with right now. Missed the FA Cup semifinal win against Chelsea, missed training on Tuesday. Pep says it's not much, but we don't know, right? We're not inside the locker room. We're not on the training table. Assuming he's right, Haaland is the pick, right? They have important games. He's going to be playing. They're still in the title race. Like that's sort of how they salvage this season, is by going out and winning the Premier League title after Champions League disappointment. And there's no more Champions League, which should allow Haaland to rest up and actually play. Their only other non-Premier League game at this point is the FA Cup final. So I do see Erling Haaland winning this. Would it shock me if somebody else does? No, it's really, really tight right now. Margins are thin in this golden boot race. Cole Palmer gets hot. Maybe he ends up winning it. Isak, along that run of form, Taylor, that you mentioned as they close out the season, Newcastle, he could absolutely bag 5 goals and Haaland could go a bit quiet. All this is possible, but I feel like at this point I've learned enough to know not to bet against Erling Haaland, and so I will not be doing that now.
Yep. I think if you told me Haaland's going to play 5 of the next 6 games,
I would still say certainly.
Haaland. If you said 4 of the 6, I might still believe that's going to happen, because I think there's a good chance he finishes with like 26 goals. I think we're still waiting for a game from him in these remaining 6 where he goes off for a hat trick or something like that. I think he's going to score plenty, even if it is just to remind us that he takes penalties and is an important player for Manchester City after some of the concerns and some of the doubts about him this season. I would be very surprised if it's not Erling Haaland at the end.
So the tiebreaker, is it minutes played? It's not assists, right? It's minutes after.
Oh, is it? I don't know. But assist, can we all agree that assist is the dumbest possible tiebreaker for Golden Boot?
I think in the Premier League, it is minutes, which I would assume Haaland has had less.
I don't know. I just assumed it was assists, which always makes me angry because it makes no sense, because the award is not about assisting. It's about scoring. I don't know the answer to that, Ryan, but I desperately hope you're right.
I wouldn't assume he has less, but I might assume he has fewer. Stannis Baratheon just gave me a high five.
Okay. Wow.
We all deserve high fives for not knowing the answer to the question I've just posted there, by the way. Well done to everybody involved.
Good work, team.
If only we had some sort of host who would have the background information necessary to answer
these
questions.
Do you mean knowing the answer to a question before asking it? Yeah, that would have been smart. Anyway, Trevor Jiffers, we'll look that up for the end of the episode. Thank you very much.
No, Palmer has fewer minutes right now than Erling Haaland. Boom, baby. Ryan, Ryan, your bet's looking better if, in fact, your Golden Boot tiebreaker is correct.
Yes, it is. Excellent. Trent, thank you very much. Matt Adler's got a question here. What is next for Tim Ream? He seems to have fallen down the pecking order at Fulham. Should he stay? Should he make a move to Europe? Should he come to MLS? Joe, he's 37 in October. Might his next move be not
starting
playing
for Chelsea?
Both of those equal possibilities in my mind. So we sort of know what's next for Tim Ream, or at least we think we do, in that he just signed a new contract with Fulham that will see him remain a Fulham player until the summer of 2025. At that point, he'll have been at the club for a decade. So it sort of feels like between that nice even round decade number and this new deal that he will still be playing for Fulham in a year from now. I'd be pretty surprised if that wasn't the case, because he's still involved there, right? He has lost his starting spot. He had a calf injury. He missed about 5 weeks in December and early mid-January with that calf injury. And now he is like sort of the third center back in the squad rather than starting every game alongside Calvin Bassey. So things have changed. And in a lot of ways, that feels like a natural step for Tim Ream in his career. I don't think it's impossible that he wins the starting job back, but we sort of know Tim Ream's limitations as a player at this point. And we know that soccer players don't play soccer forever at the professional level. So we will see him phase out one way or the other. I think he will stay at Fulham for the next season. I think he'll hit that decade mark after that. If there was not a World Cup the following summer, I would say, hey, maybe Tim Ream's going to be done. I don't know Tim Ream personally. I don't know his ambitions. I would imagine that given the state of the U.S.'s center back pool, he still sees a real opportunity for himself to be involved in 2026. So my thought for Tim Ream, play one more year at Fulham, finish out your contract there, hit the nice clean decade mark, and then come back to MLS. And there's a couple different MLS clubs that I think would really be a good place for him. I think there are many more MLS clubs that would be interested in getting him on a team-friendly deal so that he can stick around and be in the spotlight and be playing games ahead of the 2026 World Cup on home soil. I think that that landing spot in Major League Soccer makes sense for him after one more season.
Yeah.
Taylor, do you concur?
I think, Ryan has celebratory balloons going off for some reason. Congratulations, Ryan. Host of the year right there, I guess. We found out. I think Joe has raised a point about the 2026 World Cup that I had not considered. And that is an interesting one, that if he does see that as a possibility, then
which
I
he
think
should.
Extend,
I think we can agree he absolutely should think that as a possibility right now.
But he also might see coaching as a possibility. And that's the other avenue I could see him go. If, with that year remaining, even if he's not going to be a consistent player, maybe he is still a leadership figure with that team at Fulham. Maybe it's then him transitioning into a coaching role, transitioning into an assistant under Marco Silva or an academy team or something like that, if that's the route he wants to go. It does also seem like Greg Berhalter likes him a lot as a leadership figure and a player, obviously, but maybe it's even then still playing, but taking on more of a leadership role, maybe as an assistant for Greg Berhalter. That's an area I could see him go as well, is sort of that transition into the veteran player becoming a coach, either at club level or for the national team. But I think Joe is onto something, that you finish out that next year where you're playing limited minutes, which maybe allows you to stay just a little bit more fit. Counterintuitive as that might be when you're 37 or 38, it makes sense. Then going to Major League Soccer, where it is about sort of getting minutes, but maintaining that fitness so that you could potentially be eligible to play in 2026. That would be pretty fascinating. I do sort of hope that that is not a conversation we're having, because other center backs could come on and sort of raise their esteem, raise their ranking, and maybe he is a depth option if things go horrifically wrong. I don't know if I love the idea of 2026 with him as one of our two or three best center backs, but we'll see how things pan out for everybody else before we start worrying about that.
We shall indeed. Which MLS franchise would you like to see him go to, Taylor?
The obvious one in my mind is St. Louis, because that's where he's from. That's where he played club soccer and I believe university as well. I think he was a Billiken. Joe, I don't know if he fits their style. They're the St. Louis Billikens.
Are you saying Billiken?
Billiken.
What is that?
I think it's a ram. I might be wrong.
It's a doll of some sort? Question mark.
Well, so I have a Billiken doll, carved from a whale tooth from Alaska, but I thought it was something else. But yeah, there you go.
Huh.
But they are the Billikens. I guess they're the dolls. I think they have a ram for a mascot. I don't know. I just remember them beating UVA and trying to figure out what a Billiken was when I was 12. But I think it would make sense for him to be in St. Louis. I just don't know if it makes sense from a playing perspective with the pressing and the running and all of that stuff. I think of him more as a Nashville player where he can maybe hang out with Walker Zimmerman and I'll never know which one is which at any given moment. That feels more like a setting where he could land and have success.
Yeah, San Baba.
I had a very similar thought process there, Taylor. St. Louis is first on my list. I have St. Louis hometown connection, question mark. And then I have basically like scratched a line through that in my notes. I don't think the style is a great fit for him at that point. But, man, the draw to playing soccer in your hometown, maybe he's a fourth center back or third center back in that squad, still playing games, but not always in the lineup. I think that would probably be a pretty strong draw for him. I have, if all things stay the same, and they won't, but if they do, I have Columbus on this list as well. Like a center back who can just completely disorganize teams with the ball and break lines. You could apply that to the Galaxy, which is maybe a slightly stronger fit for the Galaxy of the past, in that they're only, I think, allowed to sign center backs who are over 35. So if that rule continues and the Colombian they signed is an exception, then a Tim Ream to the Galaxy, please.
I don't love him. I thought about the Galaxy as well. For some reason, that just seems destined to fail. I don't know if that's because other U.S. center backs who are maybe a little bit past their prime have gone there and not had success. I don't know if that's because Tim Ream doesn't strike me as like the L.A. marquee stylish dude that maybe would blend in with an L.A. team. I don't know why. I just have a feeling that he goes there and it's not as well received as I think Columbus is a great shout, Joe. That feels like a place where he would be valued, he would have success, and I think could also then maybe transition into a coaching role at some point. So let's get Tim Ream to Columbus in what? July of 2025?
Deal.
Cool. All right. Winning the Premier League with Chelsea, one or the other.
Update on the Premier League Golden Boot question, by the way. European Golden Shoe, the tiebreaker is minutes played. World Cup Golden Boot, the tiebreaker is Joe assists. Sorry to...
Stupid.
Premier League Golden Boot, they just share it. And it's happened on a few occasions in the past, in the 90s. It was shared three ways.
This is how you lost your empire.
frankly, I'm very disappointed by this outcome. I don't know how that works with my arrangement I made with the betting emporium.
I was
going
to say, as someone who bet on Cole Palmer to win the Golden Boot Award, you should be ecstatic about that rule.
I don't know. They'll find a way to make my agreement null and void, I would imagine.
I feel like you might have to bet on him to share it at that point.
Yeah, yeah, there might be like an each-way bet or something on that one. Yeah, so that's quite disappointing. But all I can say is Graham would have known that. We've let Graham down in this instance.
Sorry, Graham.
Sorry, Graham.
Could we spin it the other way and just say that we knew Graham would know it and so we intentionally didn't give the answer just to annoy him?
Cool,
okay.
We all knew he was wrestling a gator today, though, unfortunately. All right, let's get to our next question from Brian Avery, who says, which moment in UEFA Champions League history has brought you the most joy? Now, Taylor, I've never had a team in the Champions League, so I've never had a dog in the fight. And the one that sticks out to me is one from my childhood, which happened in 1999 at the Camp Nou. It was the final game of that tournament. It was between Bayern Munich and Manchester United.
And Bayern won, I'm assuming. They were up late in that game, as I recall.
Yes, they were until quite late on. I switched off at that point, and I think Bayern did lift the title. So I don't love when Man United win in general. They're not my favourite team, if I was to be completely transparent. But that moment, it just felt like it was incredible. It felt like the whole of England certainly was behind Manchester United at that point. It was just really, really good, exciting TV, essentially.
Yeah, man. And Solskjaer's won it. It's iconic. It still gives me goosebumps. I love watching clips of that one. There was a really good clip for a long time. I think it's still maybe on YouTube, but it's hard to find. It starts with like Sigur Rós doing the music, and then it transitions into Coldplay, and it's black and white, and then it goes color when the goal is scored. But it ends with, I believe, like the Liverpool radio broadcaster, who is obviously vehemently anti-Manchester United. Even he is sort of cheering and can't believe what's just happened. So to your point, Ryan, it does feel like a moment that sort of elevated and is really memorable. So it is that one with honorable mention, too. And this sounds petty, but it's just true. The John Terry slip in the penalty shootout for Chelsea that allowed Manchester United to then stay alive in the shootout to then go on to win in 2008. Just because it felt in that moment, as a person who really did not care for John Terry or those particular Chelsea teams, I did not want them to win. And it just felt like, oh, here we go. Like, Chelsea's going to win. John Terry's going to win. It's going to be all about John Terry. And then he slips and misses and it went the other way. And that was very, very fun for me. And then Manchester United would go on to win. So, yeah, those are the two for me, for sure.
I think a lot of it depends on the way you were at the point of the game and in the moment in your life as well. So that's a good point to make as well. That John Terry slip, for example, I was on vacation, one of the best vacations I've done. I was in Thailand. It was like 3 or 4 in the morning, local time, in a bar full of, I think it was full of Chelsea fans. So it was great to see that happen. with the 1999 final, I was at home with my family, so I've got a good memory of that. Even something like the Remontada game. I remember I watched that in an airport, and it was like one of those moments where I was in Charlotte Airport, where everyone who was a soccer fan seemed to be crowded around all the TVs in a particular bar, and it was just that sort of communal, exciting vibe to the whole thing going down.
For those unfamiliar, what is the Remontada game?
This is Barcelona coming back against PSG in the Champions League, famously. Is Remontada mean revenge or something like that? Yeah.
See.
Lots of ignorance on today's show. I do have that Barcelona comeback against PSG on my list. Coming back from 4-0 down in the first leg to beat PSG 6-1 in the second. That was the round of 16 in the 2016-17 version of the Champions League.
Means comeback.
Boom, baby. All right, there we go. That's the top answer on my list. Barcelona took that 3-0 lead in the second leg, but then Edson Cavani scores in the 62nd minute, and all of a sudden, Barcelona still need a bunch more goals at that point, and it all ends with Sergio Roberto in the 95th minute, scoring after Barcelona have a free kick. It's Ter Stegen who's forward in the box because this is it, folks. And the initial ball in doesn't connect, but then the second phase happens, and I believe it's Neymar who chips in Sergio Roberto, and Roberto slides in and scores. And basically afterwards, Sergio Roberto said, like, I didn't know if I was dreaming. I've never heard a noise like that before. And that is, and it just gives me chills thinking about it. That is such a cool moment. I've got one other comeback on my list as well. 2019 Champions League semis, Liverpool coming back to beat Barcelona. 4-3 on aggregate. It's that iconic, and honestly, maybe one of the most iconic Champions League moments ever. It's Trent Alexander-Arnold on the corner kick, walking away from the ball and then quickly doubling back to take it low and hard with that outswinger that Origi scores to make it 4-3 in the 79th minute. It's such a cool way to win a game after you already needed so many things to go your way to even be in that position in the first place. Those comebacks across the two legs are just so hard to beat.
Yeah, wonderful stuff. I'm also very fortunate enough to have been to two Champions League finals as well, so those were quite exciting. I went to the 2013 one, the Bayern-Borussia Dortmund one at Wembley Stadium, which was very fun indeed, even if the German fans were singing Three Lions afterwards. Didn't enjoy that particular part of it. I went to the 2010 final, Inter Milan, Jose Mourinho's treble-winning Inter Milan over Bayern Munich as well. That was a fun one too.
This one did not bring me joy, and kind of the opposite, because I was rooting for the team that lost. But I think if a somewhat iconic moment in that same year that Joe was just talking about would be Tottenham's comeback against Ajax. That's where I thought Joe was going to go with the Lucas Moura goal in the 96th minute, 90 plus 6th minute. That was pretty, I'm going to guess, joyful if you were a Spurs fan, less so if you were an Ajax supporter or someone who doesn't like Tottenham. But that was a pretty crazy moment, a pretty crazy comeback. So that one is an honorable mention, though it's not for me. It's for our Spurs supporting listeners.
You just reminded me of another one, Tottenham Inter Milan in 2010, I think, as well, maybe 2011. The Taxi for Mike on Gareth Bale game at White Hart Lane. That was very fun indeed, even though I don't have any particular fond regard for Tottenham Hotspur either. But that just being there in that atmosphere and watching him go off in that game was pretty special too. Very good. Very good indeed. Well done, Tottenham, for giving us such wonderful Champions League memories. Long may they continue. Thank you very much, Brian.
It could not have been less sincere.
Brian, thank you very much for your question. Indeed, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we're comparing Ancelotti to Guardiola. And we're thinking of those moments when the teams just damn the poor torpedoes and go full steam ahead. Back shortly.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hey folks, this is Taylor from the Total Soccer Show, reminding you that we are inching ever closer to the start of the summer transfer window, which means there are teams that will buy and sell their players early, there are teams that will leave that business very late, and there are teams that will operate in between. But no matter what, it's going to be a chaotic situation. There's going to be offers coming through willy-nilly. There's going to be transactions to be tracked and processed and make sure that enough money is there. There's going to be probably angry clubs calling to complain. There are many things to deal with. And unfortunately for those clubs, there is no sort of business tool that makes things easier, makes transactions simpler, gets the business done efficiently and effectively. But for the small businesses around the globe, there is such a service, Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're auctioning autographed apparel or selling sleek kits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And I really appreciate that about Shopify. No matter how big you are, no matter how fast you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify's the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. That's as many countries as we'll be selling players in the transfer window this summer. Plus, Shopify's extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/TSS, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/TSS. Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to Listener Questions. Kevin Tolley has been in touch. This one, Taylor, more of a hot take than a question, but we're going to put it in this show because it's very much worth debating as a question. Carlo Ancelotti is a better manager than Pep Guardiola. He gets similar results and does so with much less drama. Mm. So obviously, Carlo Ancelotti has won leagues in five countries. He's won four Champions Leagues. He won two as a player. Potentially a greater breadth of work, if we're going to credit Carlo Ancelotti in that respect, Taylor. Also capable of thinking things without saying them out loud,
yes,
which is a good virtue.
That is true. I went a different route. I just went with whichever one of them has managed Everton. And so Carlo Ancelotti gets the win. Remember when that happened? Remember?
That was fun.
No? Okay. This is a little bit apples and oranges for me, but fruit can still be compared. So I think Carlo Ancelotti seems to be, to an outsider, the better vibes manager, who is less demanding about specifics. And so I think if that's what the situation requires, he is probably going to get the better of results and be less frustrated overall. But Pep Guardiola has never failed, to my mind, like, right? Like, he does everything he does with Barcelona, he does everything he does with Bayern Munich, such that when Ancelotti comes in, there is an idea that he sort of coasts to his title because of everything that Guardiola instilled in that team and the training sessions he conducted. And then Ancelotti ends up leaving because the players felt like his training wasn't strict enough and wasn't getting the best out of them. So right there, I think there is a little bit of a comparison that if you want somebody who's going to be the arm around the shoulder kind of guy, that's going to be Carlo Ancelotti. If you want someone who's going to put his arm around your shoulder and then scream into your ear to do what he says, that is Pep. But that does lead to results. And I think Pep is, though maybe a bit more intense and maybe a bit more frustrating in a number of different ways, I think he's an overhauler. I think he can develop an identity for your club, and I think he can have success doing so along the way. I think they both tend to manage teams that have money and spend money. Pep maybe a little bit more just because he's only been at the three places so far. Ancelotti has spread it around a bit. But I think in the end, I would lean Pep. I would say Pep is the better manager. But it is a closer conversation than I expected it to be. For me, I'm not sure it is for Joe.
Clearly, both of them have done a lot of things at an elite level for a long time. I want to start out by saying that I think both of these managers would reject the premise of the question, and I sort of do as well. Pep Guardiola, if you ask him, like, what's the key to your success, what's he going to tell you? He's going to tell you that he has great players. If you ask Carlo Ancelotti what the key is to his success, what's he going to tell you? He's going to tell you eyebrows. You're right, Taylor. That's right. My bad. Actually, strike all that I'm about to say. It is Ancelotti because the eyebrows. No, they're both going to tell you, hey, like, we have fantastic players. And if someone else was in our shoes and didn't have those players, they would have a much, much harder time. So I think both are excellent managers. I also, what am I missing on the drama at City angle? Is this like Kyle Walker being benched or what?
Is it more just the intensity
that
Pep has?
I wouldn't really describe that as drama, though. Would you guys?
I'd say Ancelotti is very drama-free. We know nothing of any.
Yeah, Florentino Perez soaks up all the drama in the news cycle in Madrid. I don't know. I don't really get that part of the question, but we can still talk about it while setting that aside. I think both are excellent managers. For me, Pep is the better coach. I think his success is more repeatable with the right level of investment, of course, and by that I mean players. Like, he needs great players to execute his system at the level that it's been executed across his three jobs. Like, I think his success is more repeatable than Ancelotti's has been. And I think, and this is where I put a lot of value in the detailed tactical nature of what Pep does, I think there's real value in the structure that Pep implements and has implemented at each job, and the consistency that it has clearly helped bring in terms of success, in terms of going out there and identifying players who fit in the transfer market. Ancelotti has done, like I said, so many things. While you look at how even he's handled Real Madrid this season, let's be honest, he has a lot of quality. He was dealt a fairly tough hand. Like, oh, hey, try to figure out how to win multiple trophies this year without like us going out and signing a replacement for Karim Benzema. That's not easy to do. And he and Jude Bellingham and the players, of course, deserve a ton of credit. Like, Real Madrid as a group have figured out a way to squeeze a lot of juice out of that lemon. So I have a ton of respect for Carlo Ancelotti, but I think the consistency of Pep's success and the way that he sets up his team are connected. And for me, they're connected maybe a bit more closely than they are with Ancelotti. Although, again, I think everybody involved in this question would probably reject it.
I guess I can see, I agree with what you said, Joe. I think I can see where Kevin Talley is coming from if you see drama, including transfers, because I do think Pep is more likely to demand expenditure in certain areas. And then even if he gets that spend, if the player doesn't fit exactly how he wants, or he doesn't feel like the player is living up to the standard that he expects, he will then demand another signing. And that's been the case with their, like, the significant number of fullbacks that they have signed. He went through a couple goalkeepers there for a while. And so I can see that idea that Pep seems to be more demanding of players coming in, and then also more willing to part ways with a player if they aren't doing what he's asking, or if they don't necessarily fit the style, João Cancelo being a prime candidate for that. Whereas Ancelotti, this might be recency bias, and a lot of it has to do with the way this team at Real Madrid has been built and the success they've had along the way. They're obviously still spending money, but it doesn't feel as much like Ancelotti is there screaming, if I don't get these four players, I'm out. We're not going to have any success. It feels like he's more likely to work with the players he has in the way that he can. And I think that means he isn't married to one style necessarily. He's willing to adapt and adjust and do different things based on the personnel he has, which I think there's an argument that that makes him a better manager. If you are able to do theoretically more with less and demand less along the way, but I just still think you can't argue with how consistent Pep's successes have been and how strong his teams have been, even with the money spent. I think, like, you don't have a Barcelona team necessarily that was spending, I mean, I guess they spent plenty, but I think you still have the La Masia players coming through, Bayern Munich, obviously, you have academy players and existing players there. So yes, he has big clubs with big amounts of money spent that allows him to have success, but he still has success and still shapes those teams and their identities. It's not as though Carlo Ancelotti won the Premier League with Everton. It's not as though, did he win the Premier League or did he win Serie A with Napoli? I don't believe he did. I don't think you've seen Carlo Ancelotti have as much joy with smaller or medium-sized clubs. So you don't really have that comparison either. Yeah, he's won, as manager, he's won with Milan, he's won with Chelsea, he's won with PSG and Real Madrid and Bayern Munich.
Five total. No, yep, and it'll be six. It'll be sixth year with Real Madrid.
Yeah, but like, I wouldn't say any of those are small clubs, you know? So I think then it sort of, that evens out a little bit, that argument, and I still end up saying Pep. Though, again, it's closer than I thought.
Well, that's the one differentiator, isn't it, Taylor, essentially? That we've seen Ancelotti get mid-table finishes with Everton and, you know, not get to the very top with Napoli as well, whereas Pep has never had that challenge. So we can't fully get the comparison because of the caliber of teams that Pep has managed, right?
So, yes, and I think the obvious solution to this, based on the conversations we've had so far, Pep Guardiola to Nashville, and let's see how it goes.
With Tim Ream being his first signing,
yes,
presumably.
Joe's silence tells me that he is just fully not willing to engage in any of this. So, fine, Joe. He won't go to Nashville.
I just appreciated you guys eventually getting to where I was in terms of, like, the players are super important, because that's basically what you just said, Ryan. We can't tell fully with Pep in terms of how he does with a slightly more difficult situation. Ancelotti, we know, has been in that situation and hasn't necessarily thrived, because it's really, really hard to go out there and win games when you don't have the best possible players at your disposal. And we've never seen that with Pep. And I genuinely would like to, because I'm fascinated to see how things would go.
Yeah.
And he has, before people get too annoyed with the way we're answering this one, it's not as though Pep is a, like, kind of like what I think Jose Mourinho became later on, of a, I need this player or we won't have success. And then if that player doesn't achieve, I need you to sign somebody else who can, and very rigid in that mentality. Pep has that, but then there's also John Stones becoming a central midfielder, like Kyle Walker becoming a right center back who's still kind of a right back. Maybe that's less of a transition, but I do think you've seen Pep adapt players and evolve players and have them do different things. And then as he sees that they're capable of more or have greater game IQ, utilize them in more different ways. And so I think there is also still an ability to develop players and make them better than they were than they came in. I don't want it to just sound like we're saying Pep just signs players and gets the best players and then they win. I think he still has to mold those players and get more out of them to continue to elevate those performances. And I think he does that pretty consistently.
And Joe, while you might be right that you know, eventually coaching will just be done by AI or whatever, like, it is the players that are
important. To be clear, never said that. Continue.
I'm paraphrasing. But you can't, and we talked about the tactical side of both of these managers,
yeah.
But what you have to account for is their leadership qualities and the presence they both have as well. I was listening this week to a really good interview with Glenn Hoddle on the Quickly Kevin podcast, where he managed at Swindon. He was player manager there. He's manager at Chelsea. Obviously, he's manager at England as well. He told an anecdote about when he arrived at Swindon and the first signing he made was a washing machine. So the kit, the person who washed their kits, a lovely old lady who did their kits, was really unhappy and came to him and said, "We need more money for the, you know, to get the kits washed." And his logic was, if she's someone the players see every single day, and if she's unhappy in her role,
totally,
that comes towards the player. So it's about a holistic management. And the first thing he did was buy a washing machine.
I love that.
The player.
I love that so much.
Pep did that too, right? Isn't that why he signed Calvin Phillips? Just to wash all the team's jerseys? Is that not...
No, I take your point on that. It's those things are clearly important. And I think we've all been in work situations where, like, you feel that really positive culture. Like, we all like coming to work together and enjoy spending time together. And this job, and I think the product would suffer if that wasn't the case. Like, I back all of that. I think that's pretty clear to us to see. The problem is, like, we don't know those things. We're not inside the locker room in Real Madrid. We're not inside the locker room at Man City. So those are just, like, sort of floating percentages of value that we'll never actually understand.
That is true. But hopefully the results are on the page and we see them, Joe. There we go. Kevin, thank you very much. Very good question there indeed. One final question for this episode from Brian Hansen, who asks, do you have any favourite damn the torpedoes full speed ahead moments from top tier soccer? He's thinking of matches like the Tottenham versus Chelsea game last November with Udogi and Romero dismissed, Madison and Van de Ven leaving injured before half time, and Big Ange insisting on pushing their line incredibly high while it was still a 1-1 draw. So this is a great question, Joe. Obviously, Brian's referring to that sort of 0-7-1 formation that Tottenham persisted with and got Graham very excited because, like, we're going to see this all season long. You know, that very gung-ho approach. I think we see snippets of this quite a bit. And I think we even saw a snippet of this in the Derby della Madonnina on Monday as we record, with Milan desperately trying to stop Inter from winning the title. Throwing Mike Maignan up for a couple of corners in the last few minutes and absolutely damn the torpedoes. We've got to try and get something. You see that quite a lot when it's all or nothing. Send the keeper up. You have to really push at this point, right? So there are a few of those moments to select, Joe.
Yeah, I have a goalkeeper striding forward into the box as well. Let's take ourselves back to 2018 for a moment, shall we? I don't know if
Please.
Those were better times or worse times than now. Either way, we're in 2018 in this reality. And DC United are playing Orlando City. It's 2-2. It's the 96th minute of a regular season game. Let me say that one more time. It's 2-2 in the 96th minute of a regular season game. It is a corner kick for DC United. And Ben Olsen, then the manager of DC, sends his goalkeeper, David Ousted, forward for some unknown reason that I don't even think Ben Olsen can articulate to this day. This is a regular season Major League Soccer game. We are not living in the reality where there is any form of relegation. Like, this is all about vibes from Ben Olsen. A point would have been fine. Like, a point is a fine result in a Major League Soccer game in August. It's okay. And Ben Olsen sends his goalkeeper forward, And Pablo Maurer did a great oral history of this moment because there's something more coming that I'm guessing folks are already clued into. But Pablo Maurer did a great history of this moment for The Athletic. And a couple lines in there are Wayne Rooney remembering seeing David Ustead go forward and saying, like, dude, what are you doing? And then Lucho Acosta turning around and being incredibly confused as well, because now their goal is wide open and it's a tie game. And if they don't get this corner kick to go in, Orlando City have an open goal. The corner kick is taken. Orlando clear the ball away. DC United are in some sort of panic. And it's Wayne Rooney who goes back, collects the ball, strides forward, plays that bombing diagonal into the left side of the box for Lucho Acosta, who scores, and it's a game winner. That is Ben Olsen's, like, hey, we are going full throttle. It's time for 3 points. I'm sick of us getting draws and having poor results. DC not good to that point in the season. That's one of my all-time favorite MLS moments. And to be honest, I've forgotten that the goalkeeper came forward. All I remembered was the Rooney to Acosta bit. I didn't remember the context around it of, like, hey, this was on paper a pretty meaningless game in the middle of a Major League Soccer season, but Ben Olsen clearly did not feel that way, and it's now become one of the most memorable moments in a club in DC that have plenty of those memorable moments to go around.
4D chess from Ben Olsen, if you ask me.
Really is.
Good stuff. Taylor, any nominations?
Yeah, I've got a couple for you. I would say dishonorable mention of sorts to Jurgen Klinsmann when he was with the U.S. I would say the 4-1 loss to Brazil, where he persists with kind of strange experimentation, like playing Alejandro Bedoya as a number 6, which he had never played and was injured. That felt like Klinsmann continuing to be like, yeah, I know we got to prepare for a World Cup and we got to kind of progress this program, but I'm just going to keep throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what fits, and that did not fit. But that doesn't quite fit the purposes of the question. I would say the two that more readily come to mind would be Unai Emery and Petr Cech at Arsenal, when Unai Emery is really trying to get them to play out of the back and play a more possession style and utilize distribution from the goalkeeper. Petr Cech seemed more or less incapable of doing that and has mistakes in, to my mind, like every single game he played in. He has a horrific one against Swansea that you can look up where he basically passes it straight to, I think it's Jordan Ayew for the goal. He has one in Man City where he gives it right to them. And his distribution is just so erratic, but he's Petr Cech and Arsenal spent money on him. So Unai Emery just kind of persisted with him. And I think it was this idea that, look, this is the way we're going to play. We might not be great at it right away, but we're going to get there. And I think Arsenal did progress, though maybe not enough under Unai Emery to keep him in that gig. But Petr Cech did not. But that felt like one where they were kind of persisting with that mentality. And then Leeds in their first game back in the Premier League with Marcelo Bielsa in charge. It's against Liverpool. It's Bielsa Klopp. It's murder ball versus heavy metal football. It's a 4-3 final, and it's just Liverpool scores, Leeds scores. Liverpool leads, Liverpool leads, Liverpool at the end in extra time, I think, or injury time, rather. And it's both of them just playing the high press, going at each other. It's Bielsa refusing to compromise, refusing to sort of sit back or do anything overly defensive. Every pass is forward for Leeds. Pretty much every pass is forward for Liverpool, and it's both teams just kind of slugging it out. That felt like one where there was a refusal to adjust and fully just foot on the gas from Leeds and Bielsa.
That's good. Maximum entertainment. I love that. Very good indeed. We've probably seen a few Liverpool moments like that over the years.
I would say so.
Recall some more, but yeah, definitely and Bielsa moments.
Joe, is the Berhalter loss to Mexico, that early loss, is that maybe a candidate as well?
Wow.
Where it's sort of like, yeah, we're going to get destroyed in this friendly. We can't really play out of the back, but we need to learn how to do it, and we need to learn how to do it against opponents who won't let us, so we're going to take this L if it means we learn from it.
In the most weird soccer nerd way possible, and I mean that as nothing but a compliment in terms of that suggestion, absolutely it is. Like, I feel like that is 2019 Greg Berhalter's version of doing exactly what this question's asking about. That was a huge disappointing loss for the United States, albeit in a friendly, and one that I think Berhalter maybe came away from thinking, like, oh, I should change how I think about this job. But really, if Damn the Torpedoes is we're going to spread the field and try to build from the back under pressure from Mexico and be really bad at it, then yeah, I think it absolutely does qualify.
Not sure playing out the back is full speed ahead per se, but
well, that's kind of what I mean. Like underneath the soccer like nerd category, and Berhalter, I'm sure would tell you that he fits in that category as an individual. I think it kind of does fit in its own special way.
Yeah, very good. To come back to your DC United example, Joe, is there anything in soccer more exciting than a moment when a goalkeeper goes up to the opposing box to try and attack a corner, particularly in a league game as well, which you do see sometimes. I think. it's one of the most exciting things that can happen in regular play.
Agreed. Yeah, it's not the most exciting, but it's definitely towards the top of the list because you know that something's about to go down, right? Or at least you feel more confident that there's about to be a moment of chaos. Either you're faced with the potential of a goalkeeper scoring a goal, which is awesome, or you've got an extra number in the box and you're going to try to get a shot off with the man advantage, or there's about to be a counterattack coming right down the other way into an open net. So your chances of having something fun happening in the next 30 seconds, I think, skyrocket.
Yeah, absolutely. Good stuff. Brian Hansen, thank you very much indeed for your question. Thank you to everybody who has submitted questions. TotalSoccerShow.com/questions if you'd like to do so as well. Or if not, join our Discord. Once again, Patreon.com/TotalSoccerShow. Thank you to everybody who supports us there. You can have a chat with us in the Discord. Some bonus episodes coming up on the feed, as I mentioned, including a bonus question, which we're answering, or we're giving our messages to Gianni Infantino, coming up on the feed very shortly. But for now, Taylor Rockwell, thank you very much for listener questioning with us.
Thank you, my friend.
Joe Lowry, pleasure as always, sir.
And to you, sir.
And listener, thank you the mostest. We'll be back on this feed very shortly. But for now, bye.